Good afternoon. I'm Kate Manahan. Thank you for listening to What Mama Wants. I kind of think Mother Earth wants less toxics and more health for her whole planet. This is a chance to hear from educators, citizens, policymakers, and scientists about the role toxics, like mercury, PFAS, pesticides, are playing in our daily lives. My guest today is marine science researcher and oyster farmer, Abby Barrows. She initiated the first baseline data map of microplastic pollution in Maine back in 2012, and more recently was the principal investigator for the Global Microplastics Initiative, compiling one of the largest global data sets on every ocean and continent in the world, enabling a rare glimpse at the extent of plastic contamination in remote and understudied ocean and fresh waters. Abby, thank you so much for joining me on What Mama Wants today.
Thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. Before we talk about your extremely cleverly designed research, I wondered if we could start with just the fundamentals of the toxics of plastics, especially as they break down into micro and nanoplastic bits in the waters of the world.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's always really important to define what we're talking about, especially since there have been some different definitions thrown around for microplastics. But they are a pollutant that has emerged as an issue of international concern really in the last 12 years. They're defined as a piece of plastic between 1 micron and 5 millimeters in size. And it's really important to think of microplastics as a suite or a class of contaminants. It's not just this one thing. They're really diverse. They come from different products and polymer types, and they have the shared characteristics of being non-biodegradable. Microplastics absorb and release chemicals. They fragment, but they don't disappear. And they come in different shapes, sizes, and colors, with microfibers being the most commonly found. So far, microplastics have been found in all the world's oceans, from surface waters to deep ocean trenches. They've been found in freshwater environments, tap water, bottled water, our beverages, beer, agricultural soils, honey, table salt, birds, human placenta, breast milk, and our air. This is an issue, not just because it's kind of gross that there's plastic everywhere, but because of the chemicals associated with microplastics. For example, in the aquatic environment, there are many ambient toxicants, and most of these are known as the persistent organic pollutants, or POPs, which is a cute abbreviation for something pretty insidious. And these are compounds that are resistant to environmental degradation, on the legacy compounds. So the physical and the chemical properties of plastic and microplastic facilitates the attraction and concentration of these chemicals, sometimes up to a million magnitudes higher than the surrounding seawater. So they are also releasing this hazardous additives that they are made with into the environment. So think of BPA or phthalates or DDT, PAHs, PCBs. And all of these chemicals have known negative human and environmental health effects. So unfortunately, this tiny, seemingly insignificant piece of plastic can become this very toxic sponge and transport POPs and the associated additives around the world and into different habitats and animals.
Whew, that is terrifying. You know, I was recently swimming at a lake and I saw one of those docks that's floating on like a foam block. Mm-hmm. And I could see that it was all deteriorated. And I thought, and then the fish eat it. And then we eat the fish. And then it breaks down in littler particles and releases those chemicals inside us. And wow.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. The smaller it is, the more accessible it is for animals to ingest either directly out of the environment, bringing its food, or indirectly through eating a prey item that contains plastic. And we're not going to talk about nanoplastics today, but that's a whole nother field of research that is definitely concerning.
Well, if we're talking about microplastics today, maybe 12 years from now, all those micros will become nanos, right? And yeah. Then we'll be talking about nanos crossing our blood-brain barrier. You said they're already in placentas?
Yep. So that we also do know that the smaller microplastics, so on the lower micron scale, they do pass through the blood membrane barrier and enter into the different body systems.
And a body that's been exposed to a lot of microplastics is going to break down in many different systemic ways, right?
Yep, the jury's still out on a lot of the human health implications and how long the residence time is of plastics in our bodies. But if it's not just in our digestive tract, because we are seeing that we do pass through a lot of plastic, but if it is translocating into other body systems, then it seems like it might find a more permanent place in our body.
Well, that's terrifying. Thanks for coming.
Sorry.
This must be tough dinner party conversations for you.
Yeah, I was not very fun to invite to a cocktail party for many years, and I've tried to temper that a little bit, but it's something I think a lot about all the time.
Yeah. I think when you first learn it, your hair's on fire and you have to talk about it, but then you realize you're playing a long game. Mm-hmm. Then you start doing that more strategic legislation, organization, education that goes with that.
That's cool.
I think you've taken a kind of yucky situation with toxics in our water and have done something so brilliant. It's like the very opposite. You've been the principal investigator for the Global Microplastics Initiative, mapping the plastic contamination in the water virtually everywhere. I wondered if you could explain the way you were able to gather water from every corner of the planet, because I think this is really cool.
Yeah, that was just an amazing experience and opportunity that I had. I approached and partnered with a nonprofit organization called Adventure Scientists. We launched the Global Microplastics Initiative in 2015, and then we expanded into the Global Freshwater Initiative as well. So they primarily managed the citizen scientists, and I ran all other aspects of the project in terms of processing samples. I'd always been really interested in citizen science, and I worked at the Shaw Institute, and we had a small volunteer water quality monitoring program. And around that time is when I first learned about microplastics. And so I sort of plugged that into the monitoring program, asking my volunteers to collect water samples, and I started processing in the lab in Blue Hill. And through that, I recognized the power of harnessing all those people that were passionate about the waters. Because I was out on the boat monitoring and collecting water samples twice a week, and that's all I could manage in terms of all the other things. And once I plugged in this team of people all over the peninsula, it really helped paint a clearer and bigger picture in terms of what was happening with microplastic pollution in the area. And so that got me thinking more, and I stumbled across Adventure Scientists, and their connection was with adventurers, so professional athletes, people doing crazy things in remote and hard to get to parts of the world. And it was a really good match for this project. And so the executive director and I hit it off, and we just ran for it. The adventurers really, really leaned into this project. The amount of interest was pretty overwhelming. I mean, we had thousands of adventurers collect samples over those multiple years and collected over 2,500 samples over the course of the project.
So these are people who climb glaciers and scuba dive, right?
Yeah, and circumnavigate the Arctic and row from California to Hawaii just because you can, or fly to the Easter Islands and paddleboard around it. You know, people who have a unique skill set for being out in some of these pretty rugged environments. And it turns out that that skill set often lends itself to that person being pretty meticulous and reliable in terms of collecting high quality data.
So that is interesting, right? These are people who can pack a little bag and live on it for a long time. They know how to follow the directions and collect a clean sample. That's really cool. So you've touched water from all over the world.
I try not to touch it because I didn't want to contaminate it.
Okay. You've worked with
water. Yes. Yes, I
That's
have.
Brilliant. I just love that so much. And your findings were?
Well, there were some interesting and surprising findings. For the marine samples, we found an average of 12 pieces of microplastic per liter of water. So that's across the globe, anywhere scooped. The average was 12 pieces. And I thought that was pretty high.
And you had said the chief microplastic is from fibers, from clothing?
Yep, 90% of the plastics that we quantified were microfibers, and the majority of those were invisible to the naked eye, so less than 1.5 meters in size, and that was a smaller size than those captured in the majority of other surface studies that have been done. that has a lot to do with the technique that we use. It's just a grad sample. So just scooping up a liter of surface water from the ice filter in the lab. So it was giving us a much more clear picture of what was occurring. And we also found quite a bit of plastic in fresh water, but much less than in the marine environment. So again, sort of reinforcing thought that the ocean is the a resting place for a lot of plastic. We found that 1.5 pieces of plastic per liter of fresh water.
Yeah, quite a bit less, but still, who wants to drink plastic in their fresh water?
Right.
Certainly not the moose and the chickens.
No. The surprising thing from the study was that we found that microplastic concentration is higher in the open ocean than in coastal environments. In some ways, you think, oh, it'd be higher along the coast because of the land and freshwater inputs into the waters there. But it appeared that a lot of the plastics are getting sort of trapped out in those gyres and in those ocean currents. And if you think about it, you know, currents are moving along the coast and moving into the open ocean. And so it's transporting a lot of that plastic. We also found that the microplastic concentration was highest in the polar oceans. And that has since been further validated by many other studies and concerning for a number of reasons, but it seems like it's sort of a zone that plastics are getting trapped in.
Yeah, it seems that some areas, islands, just make kind of that swirl effect, huh?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's 5 large gyres. So these are just huge convergent zones in the ocean. We have one in the North Atlantic, one in the South Atlantic, one in the North Pacific, South Pacific, and one in the Indian Ocean. But there is a high concentration of all different sized plastics out in those gyres.
Something else to learn lots about. Science is often studied in siloed parts. In your case, marine research, but what does your microplastics research tell us about when you put it all together? What does microplastics inform us about biology, climate change, and other sciences that it is intertwined with?
Yeah, that's something which has been more of a new thing for me to connect some of those dots. I think I was just so head down in the research for years. But the more I sort of looked up from my microscope, the more I realized how interconnected plastic pollution is with all these other ecosystems and a lot of our climate change issues. So I think it's really important to recognize that microplastic pollution is a climate change issue because every step of plastic production, from extraction to disposal, contributes to greenhouse gas emissions. So if you think about the oil extraction and the piping of that oil, the refinement, moving of that to petrochemical facilities, the production of either those plastic pellets that are shipped around and molded into things or another feedstock, all the transport that involves, and then how energy intensive it is to create a plastic product. So then that plastic product is shipped to a store and you purchase that. That's then transported to your home or wherever you're going. Or in case of single-use plastic, you might be using it for a few minutes before it's chucked away. And then even if that's recycled, there's a lot of emissions that are associated with recycling and the transport of plastic materials all over the world. Plastic is the second largest product that we export here in the U.S., or it's landfilled. And we know that as those plastics fragment, they are emitting greenhouse gases as well.
We track whales sometimes and see where they migrate to and where they mate and whatnot. It'd be really interesting to put one of those trackers on a plastic pellet and see what kind of crazy journeys around the world that makes in order for us to use it for. Did I hear 50% of plastic is used for 30 seconds?
Yeah, I think it's pretty hard to quantify that. But I think that, yeah, most single-use plastic is really just used for a very minimal amount of time, a few minutes at the longest before it's discarded, which is a crazy way to use a resource that seemingly lasts forever.
Yeah, distressing way to use it. I think you were about to say something else.
Oh,
though.
Yeah, well, just something, recent research that just came out and made me think about plastics and climate change in a whole nother light was how airborne, so microplastics are airborne, so they're actually being transported to a lot of these remote areas in the world, have been found to either absorb or scatter sunlight, which ultimately can influence temperatures on the Earth's surface. This is really new science, and the conclusions are tricky. since unlike other aerosols, things that are floating in the air, microplastics can come in all those different shapes, sizes, and colors. But it does appear that microplastics, especially on urban areas, could have localized cooling or warming effects, depending on how they vary in their concentration.
Wow, that's really powerful. It reminds me a little bit of during 9/11, 2001, when we stopped flying the planes.
Yes.
There were less contrails, less clouds, less cloud cover. The temperatures went up and the scientists said, oh my God, we never took into account the contrails. So here we have plastics just floating around in the air that we have not factored into the equation.
Exactly. And but people are starting to think about that. So I'll be pretty curious, sort of a space to watch in the coming years in terms of what that means for different regions and areas.
Yeah. Rachel Miller last week talked about how when we wash our fleece and then we dry our fleece in our drying machines, it kicks out all those microplastics right into the air, right, you know, maybe next to your garden.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in air and in the soil. I mean, I just actually cleaned out our dryer lint just the other day. And I really tried to avoid synthetic clothing, but just even cotton and wool, you know, and the dyes associated with clothing, what that's doing short and long term.
Yes, the dyes. I saw somebody walk by me today in a bright neon color. And I thought, that was not made with anything natural. That's a petrochemical, right?
Right.
Even if you had an organic wool sweater and it was dyed neon orange, you're dipping into the ugly well.
Yeah, well, we got to figure out how the tropical fish are getting those good neon colors.
That's right. That's right. You do it au natch. If you're just joining this conversation, welcome. You're listening to What Mama Wants, Less Toxics and More Health. I'm Kate Manahan, and my guest today is Abby Barrows. We've been talking about her marine research, but Abby also applies her knowledge of the local waters as the owner and operator of Long Cove Sea Farm, an oyster business up in Stonington, Maine. You're really conscientious about microplastics. How do you think about oysters and how do you think about purchasing seafood?
Yep, this is something I've thought a lot about. So I've been an oyster farmer since 2015. So I purchased this farm sort of in the height of my global microplastics initiative project. But one of the reasons I was attracted to oyster farming was that the more I learned about oysters, the more I realized that they were truly a sustainable fisheries in terms of the restorative factor for the local ecosystem, how they clean the water in terms of improving water clarity and pick out nitrates and phosphates, so improve water quality, helps more diverse species thrive in that area, such as seagrasses or seaweeds, which in turn are nurseries for other fish species. And also, historically, the oyster reefs really prevented a lot of storm surging on the coast. So all those pieces really spoke to me. But seafood in general, growing up on the island, it's always been part of my diet. And I've learned more and more about sort of our seafood crises, our wild fisheries crises. And that's another reason why I got into farming oysters. But I always try to be really conscientious when I go to the store in terms of purchasing seafood, finding out where it comes from. And it's really hard to keep track of all of that. But I've found the Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch. And it's basically green, orange, and red in terms of what seafood species are they encourage you to purchase. And that's based on where the fish is coming from, how the population's doing. And I found that really useful to guide me.
Thanks. So that's Monterey Bay Aquarium.
Mm-hmm. Seafood Watch.
Thank you. So how do you keep from becoming overwhelmed by all that you know about pollution?
I think staying really proactive. So lifestyle choices that reflect what I've learned through this research journey. But also right now, I am really trying to reimagine what the future of aquaculture could look like. You know, it's summer. This is the height of the season for oyster farming. And we are in the midst of designing, building, and trialing plastic-free oyster grow-out bags. So for me, I'm a doer. Even if I fail, I like to be proactively doing something, even though it seems like a drop in terms of my tiny little oyster farm trying to do something different. My hope is that we will produce a viable and scalable alternative to the plastic gear, as that's all that is available for oyster farms.
So you're modeling this through your business, which I think is huge. Not everybody has the tools to figure that out, and you are uniquely positioned to do that. I also think about the bigger picture. How do we engage our legislatures? How do we engage our citizens? It's going to take everybody really waking up and demanding some change, I think.
Absolutely. And I think awareness, education, learning more about the issue, and then, yeah, talking to people and talking to your local reps and signing petitions. There are a lot of resources out there.
Yep. And there are a lot of people running for office right now. You can ask people who knock on your door, hey, where do you stand on plastics? And vote for the one that wants less of them and has a plan.
Absolutely. I just realized people often ask for like action items, and you know, everyone's heard the bring your own bag. There's a lot, just some things that maybe people don't think about. Like, so like eliminate coffee pods from home and work. You can bring your own lunch to work in glass, metal, or hard reusable containers. Cook more. Order ice cream in a cone instead of using a cup and a spoon. Or bring your reusable utensils when you know you might be eating out. It's pretty easy to slip those in your bag. When you order takeout, ask them not to include condiment packages. Those little sachets cannot be recycled. Use refillable pens or refillable pencils. And make sure your garbage bags are full before throwing them away. So little things like this, these things add up. Same with personal hygiene routine. So you can buy shampoo and conditioner in a bar instead of a plastic bottle, or you can refill those bottles. You know, use a razor with a refillable head. There's some awesome non-plastic razors out there. Also, you can get rid of pump soap in your house and use a bar. So that's less plastic as well. There's a lot of great bamboo and wooden toothbrushes out there. Sometimes the bristles are still plastic, but it's really reducing that quantity of plastic. Toothbrushes are found in the North Pacific Gyre all the time. Yeah, there's just a lot of great things that go beyond just remembering your reusable bag.
Yeah, thank you for that. And I would add to it, your website is a wealth of knowledge. It's just abbybarrows.com, right?
Correct.
Yes. And from there, you can link to her Facebook page, Instagram, and read the research and find out all the places where Abby's making a difference in the world. And you can join forces with those people too, including groups like Five Gyres. And what are some of the others?
Plastic Pollution Coalition has an amazing legislative toolkit that you can, you want to cite some change in your local community, you can go to their toolkit and kind of choose your own adventure through all the different resources they have for creating grassroots change. Surfrider Foundation has a lot of great facts and figures and templates for writing letters to your local representative. And Upstream Solutions, actually based here in Maine, has been doing a lot of work.
Excellent. Thank you for that. And I hope people will swing by your website and enjoy the bounty of resources there. That's abbybarrows.com. As a scientist and an oyster farmer, what do you imagine Mother Earth wants from us at this point with regard to oceans and waterways?
I think less plastic. Clearly, I think that just less consumption of these single-use plastic in particular, you know, that's really what I'm focused on because of how ubiquitous it is now in our lives. You know, you can't really go to the store and not leave with some sort of packaging that really just goes right in your bin. So less plastic.
Yeah, I think you're already answering Mama's call, you know, with your whole reimagining oyster farming. That's answering the less plastics call for sure. To close this interview, I'd like to ask you a few quick questions about your personal relationships with the earth, if you're game.
Yeah.
As a kid, what was your favorite thing to do outside in nature?
Ooh, spent a lot of time building forts, but I would have to say the thing that sticks out most is I found a small leaky boat washed up in the cove that I lived on. And I spent so much time in this 4x4, it was a square little boat. I spent so much time in that little boat, paddling around, getting stuck in the mud, you know, falling overboard at all times of the year, until one year the tide took it back But that I had so much fun, you know, hours and hours spent on the water.
Ah, little glimpses of your future right there as a child. Can you describe a scene in nature when you have felt real awe?
Absolutely. I was so privileged and lucky to be able to go to Antarctica this past winter. Sailed from Ushuaia and Tierra del Fuego in southern Patagonia, across the Drake Passage. So it was 500 miles, so multiple days at sea, big seas, just the horizon. I was out on deck when we first were approaching. And before we actually even saw the amazing mountains, we saw icebergs. And I've never seen icebergs like that. I mean, they were larger than a city block and as tall as a skyscraper. Totally awe-inspiring, totally jaw-dropping. I still don't really have the word to describe that feeling.
The contrast between like almost nothingness and then an ice city must be amazing. What's one thing your mother taught you about Mother Earth?
Ooh, great question. I think just the love of being outdoors. My mom loved hiking and was gardened and she was a sailor. I think just the desire to be outside really came from.
She'd be mighty proud of how much time you spend outside. What's one thing you wonder about in nature?
Usually if I wonder about it, I try to go out and find out more about it. But one thing that I have gone to find out more about, but I still find myself having more questions, is the complexity of the tide. I mean, I understand it in theory, and I live my life by it on the daily, but there is still a lot of mystery to me in terms of the heights, cyclical changes, and then geographically how it fluctuates all over the planet. It's very intriguing to me.
What is your favorite baby animal?
Mm-hmm. There's so many. I always just think of sea creatures, but sea creatures aren't cute. Baby Tasmanian devils. I mean, once they open their mouth, they're not so cute. They are pretty cute.
And you went to college in Tasmania, right?
Yeah, and I worked with Tasmanian devils. And so that was really fun just to be able to be around those very unique animals. Oh, baby, I don't know. There's so many cute baby animals. Baby wombats, baby koalas are just like fluff balls.
Abby, you are a most respected marine science researcher looking at some of the toughest modern realities, and still you choose to be fully engaged with the solutions to these problems. Thank you so much for having the passion to protect our watery planet. Your resilience is truly an inspiration to others, and thank you for being my guest today.
Thank you, Sate. I really appreciate the opportunity and your interest in this hard to swallow subject.
Definitely hard to swallow.